Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In 2019, the Bradford Literature Festival was the focus of a scandal following revelations that its funding came from the British government's counter-extremism spy initiative. In today's programme, we look at new disclosures about how the Bradford Literature Festival was undermined by the Israel Lobby Sojourn campaign. As always, I'll be speaking to experts on this issue to find out more after this report by Bianca Rahimi on the festival's disturbing funding sources.
In 2019, the Bradford Literature Festival was exposed to be funded by the British government counter-extremism spy funding. This scandal led to a great number of acts pulling out of the so-called Muslim-led book festival. Now it has found itself in hot water again, this time with funding from the Israel lobby. The festival, which is targeted at the Muslim community, is promising this year to host a talk by war criminal, propagandist and insufferable liar Alistair Campbell. However, a few of the funders listed in the festival programme have more than raised eyebrows in the local community. A key sponsor of the festival is none other than the Jewish Renaissance, an organization presided over by Israel lobbyist David Danger. The Danger family website describes him as a strong believer in strengthening UK-Israel ties. Danger is known to fund the Islamophobic Henry Jackson Society, the Israel Lobby Group Board of Deputies, the normalization operation Nisa Nashim, and the Jerusalem Foundation, which builds in Israeli settlements, including in Silwan and Sheikh Jarrah. The Board of Jewish Renaissance also features at least four figures from the Board of Deputies. The Editorial Advisory Board of Jewish Renaissance also features Alex Brummer, the city editor of the Daily Mail, simultaneous to chairing the Israeli regime-funded Abraham Initiatives and vice president of the Board of Deputies. The 2020 trustees' report for the Board of Deputies states that it has a close working relationship with the Israeli embassy and strengthened links to the Israeli Ministry of Strategic Affairs and the IDF. Another suspicious funder of the Bradford Literature Festival is the Aspen Institute, which is led by the Crown family. James S. Crown serves as the chairman of the board at the Aspen Institute, while his father, Lester Crown, was formerly vice chairman of the board. He remains a life trustee and is also on the board of overseers of the Henry Crown Fellowship Program of the Institute. Not only does the Crown family fund the Friends of the IDF and the Settlement Building Jewish National Fund, but also the Jerusalem Foundation, where Lester Crown is also a director. The Aspen Institute has hosted events for Ohad Zemet, the spokesperson of the Israeli embassy in the UK. The Aspen Institute also features Idan Ofer as the honorary chair of the Middle East Strategy Group. The Ofer family shipping company was revealed to be a front for Israeli intelligence. Another cultural partner is listed as the publisher Simon & Schuster. In the past, the company has hosted writing workshops, BLT, and this year is scheduled to deliver an advice workshop on getting work published for young aspiring writers. It is of note that Simon & Schuster published the book Israel, A Simple Guide to the Most Misunderstood Country on Earth by the Israeli government's special envoy for combating anti-Semitism and the delimitation of Israel, Noah Tishbe. Bradford Literature Festival is funded by Israel lobbyists, funders of settlements and the Israeli military, and is platforming the key liar and propagandist for the invasion and occupation of Iraq. This is unacceptable.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also a co-founder and co-director of a lobbying watchdog initiative, Spinwatch. We're also joined from Belgrade by Kit Klarenberg. Kit is an investigative journalist exploring the role of intelligence services in shaping politics and perceptions. He's recently broken a range of high-profile stories on the role of the British intelligence services in the manipulation of British politics. This includes an exclusive report revealing how the British journalist Paul Mason has engaged in a covert operation with British intelligence to undermine the anti-imperialist movement in the UK and US. Welcome to the show. Kit, I wonder if I could just start with you first. You broke this story about the Bradford Literature Festival in the Electronic Intifada. What's your take on what's been going on there?
I mean, I think this is just the latest manifestation of the Israeli lobby's, you know, relentless quest to infiltrate and co-opt, you know, every sphere of society. We've had academia, politics, and I think that this is, the next frontier is, you know, culture, literature. And I think one of the reasons that this seemed particularly suspicious to me, and you know, indeed was notable, was the fact that in recent years, the Israeli government has significantly ramped up its funding for the arts, in particular film, because it's well understood that film is an extremely effective, you know, propaganda mechanism. And its kind of key interest is funding movies, you know, fictional movies that on the surface appear to, you know, promote harmony and unity between Jews and Muslims in Israel, but are actually kind of a Trojan horse to, you know, promote the message that, like, you know, stop struggling, stop fighting against occupation and just allow yourselves to be colonized fully.
I mean, David, as the film points out, there was a previous issue, wasn't there, with this festival over counter-extremism funding. I mean, is that a new issue? I mean, are there any connections?
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? Counter-extremism seems to be strongly connected to the question of Zionist lobbying in the UK. So many of the organisations which are funded by the counter-extremist budget are themselves Zionist organisations, and indeed many of the Zionist lobby groups do get involved in the area of counter-extremism. So there's a big crossover there. So the fact that this is an issue about Zionist funding of the festival shouldn't be seen as something entirely separate from the previous issue of counter-extremism funding, because these are part of the same set of ideological ideas. And in particular, I mean, as Kit's been saying here, in particular, the idea is if we just get people together to get to know each other and understand each other's backgrounds, then there'll be less conflict, which means, of course, there'll be less criticism of the state of Israel and its policies.
Mm. I mean, Kit, the Aspen Institute declared as a supporter of the festival, which is supposed to cater for Muslims, and yet the people associated with it have been involved in supporting settlements and the Israel occupation forces, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, I thought that this was one of the most egregious examples. I mean, what were they, you know, this can only have been, you know, very deliberate. They knew, they must have known the background of this organization. It's not a simple error, like they claimed that their BSBT funding was in 2019. I mean, yeah, this is an enormously influential, you know, kind of international, think tank come, you know, elite talking shop. But it is headquartered in Washington, and you know it is effectively it was founded and run by the enormously wealthy Crown family, who have who are committed and very vocal Zionists. The Institute has a formal alliance with the Anti-Defamation League, you know, which is a leading pro-Israel group in the U.S. And in fact, you know, its stock in trade is accusing any and all critics and indeed criticism of Israel as being anti-Semitic. It has a it has this rather insidious fellowship program, which is about training future leaders, in particular future advocates for Israel, and numerous individuals who are quite prominent in politics across the Western world, and also other fields like even like journalism have come up through that network. It's deeply disturbing that the Literary Festival thought that this was an appropriate sponsor.
Yeah. I mean, David, this guy, David Danger, I mean, how active is he in the Israel lobby's activities?
Well, Danger's an interesting guy. He's Iraqi Jewish, and he's involved in a lot of cultural-related activities. So he's not strongly involved in the more political end of the Israel lobby, although he is a vice president of the Jewish Leadership Council, so he's represented there. Mm. But he's involved strongly in a lot of cultural stuff. He's funds some arts projects, he funds interfaith work, and there's a lot of kind of activity there. And this festival is kind of one of those kinds of interventions. It's an attempt to essentially penetrate the British Muslim community and to normalise Zionism within the Muslim community. So it's a deeply dishonest and subversive activity, but it poses as being something which is softer than the harder Zionist activities. It's a kind of cultural activity which seems to be about people getting on with each other, but actually it's deeply subversive.
Mm. Kit, you, I think, in the past have previously called for a boycott, haven't you, of the festival. Is that still your view now?
Oh, no, absolutely. And I mean, I think that, Alistair Campbell's presence at that festival alone is enough to boycott it. I mean, it's just so, unspeakably tasteless and, tone deaf that he would be invited. I don't think that the festival itself will learn any lessons from a boycott, but it's imperative that it happens. Because, I think people need to know the reality of what this festival is and what purpose it's actually serving. I mean, on paper, it's a very, this kind of, it promotes harmony and unity. In reality, it's a Trojan horse for Zionist interests.
Yeah. I mean, David, do you think a boycott of the festival is possible, do you think?
It's so possible. I mean, there has been a very, very concentrated effort by both the British establishment through the counter-extremism apparatus, the intelligence agencies, and on the other hand, the Zionists, to penetrate the British Muslim community, to try and stop Muslims from opposing British foreign policy. Mm. And the only way in which that can be rolled back is if British Muslim organisations have nothing at all to do with this kind of rubbish. Mm. And I would strongly urge every Muslim organisation, and indeed every Muslim cultural producer who may be associated with this in any way, simply to withdraw from this festival, because it's a disgrace.
Well, let's just pause the discussion there for a moment and have a look at this report on how the festival seems to be being used as a vehicle for the normalisation of this entity.
A theme of this year's Bradford Literature Festival is touted as In Memory of Andalusia, which focuses on the cultural dialogue between Jewish and Muslim scholars in the Golden Age. But is this a clever subterfuge for normalisation with the temporary entity in the present context? The roots of this idea can perhaps be found in a talk for key Israel lobby group B'nait B'rith, which took place in September 2021. It featured the founder of Bradford Literature Festival, Saima Aslam, and was titled The History of Interfaith Dialogue Through Culture, Art, Literature and Politics. The use of culture as a tool of normalization with Israel was discussed at length, along with constant smearing of pro-Palestinian activism as anti-Semitism. Aslam, the founder of Bradford Literature Festival, at one point claims that the conflict, Palestine, can become a lightning rod for anti-Semitism. B'nai B'rith is part of the World Zionist Organization, formerly part of the World Zionist Congress, and states that one of its core objectives is to support the State of Israel. It also states that it is committed to defending Israel from malicious misrepresentation and ignorance. The lobby group even has a Bureau of International Affairs, which engages with the British Foreign Office embassies on behalf of Israel. International Criminal Court documents reveal that Benai Barith also submitted observations co-written with the UK Lawyers for Israel lobby group against the, quote, alleged state of Palestine. Benai Barith is so deeply entrenched in the worldwide Israel lobby machinations that it even shared an office space with the Israel Project in Washington, D.C. In addition to Saima Aslam, the founder of Bradford Literature Festival, speaking at this normalization event was Elizabeth Harris-Savchenko, who works for the Abraham Initiatives. The trustee report for the Abraham Initiatives claims it exists to increase synergy between the UK and Israeli bodies and agencies. The Abraham Initiatives is funded by the Israeli Ministries of Justice and Labour and works to whitewash Israeli apartheid in Palestine. Clearly, Bradford Literature Festival has been commandeered to serve the interest of the racist Israeli regime to astroturf normalization within the community. Bradford, beware.
David, is this just another example of an apparent use of interfaith activity as a strategy to normalize Zionism?
It is. I mean, we've seen this on many occasions in this show. I mean, we saw a few weeks ago an organisation called the Nisa Nishim, which is to bring Muslim and Jewish women together. And, of course, Nisa Nishim is funded by the same people who are funding this festival. This is clearly part of the same kind of thing. They also fund other interfaith activities. The Faith and Belief Forum, for example, another example of an organisation dedicated to subverting the Muslim community and its support for criticism of British foreign policy. So yes, this is a strategy which is developed and was developed by the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and which has been rolled out through a whole range of organisations in this country and funded by a whole range of Zionist philanthropists. So yes, this is clearly a part of the strategy of the State of Israel.
Kit, you've done a fair bit of reporting on the Zionist lobby in the UK, haven't you? I mean, did its involvement in the Literature Festival surprise you at all?
No, not at all. I mean, like I said, you know, the culture is the next frontier, and it's an ideal audience for, you know, yes, normalizing Zionist propaganda. And yeah, the fact that it is regarded as a, you know, a Muslim festival lends this a legitimacy and a kind of a kind of grassroots character, when in reality it's, you know, a very, very, very deliberate deception.
Yeah. I mean, and David, I see that Benai Barith appear to be very strongly integrated into the Zionist movement. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
So Benai Barith is an organisation which is international. It started off in the States over a century ago now, a long-term pro-Zionist lobby group. But since the creation of the State of Israel in 1948, it's been part of the membership of the World Zionist Organisation, thus centrally integrated into the transnational Zionist movement. It has a branch in the UK. It set up the ADL, in the Anti-Defamation League in the US. In fact, it also helped set up the Union of Jewish Students in this country. So it's very central to the Zionist movement. And it's been part of this literature festival. Now, what we see here is a whole range of different groups. And we see this week after week, don't we? A whole range of different groups whose names probably are unfamiliar to people who are viewing this program, but they are all, you know, within two steps connected to each other. And it's extraordinary, this network of organizations connected to each other and very similar ideologically and having the same kinds of strategies.
Kit, can you tell us what sort of lessons in general can we take from this whole experience?
Well, I mean, I think it amply underlines the necessity to look very, very, very carefully into, yes, the financial arrangements and the kind of, you know, political or ideological connections of the people who support these kind of events. Because on paper, I mean, you know, Alistair Campbell's presence aside, like, this looks like a perfectly normal and indeed, you know, perfectly agreeable literature festival. In reality, it is serving a very dark purpose, quite clearly. And yes, the Zionist sympathies of its founders are extremely notable and no doubt like play a significant role in informing the true unstated purpose of this festival. And it's increasingly, as we've discussed, the Zionist lobby is trying to infiltrate and co-opt every sphere of society, every democratic space. So be extremely careful, because the next time you go to a concert, or the next time that you attend a gallery show, it could be that it is serving some kind of clandestine objective.
David, there was a reference to the UK Lawyers for Israel in the film. What is this organisation?
So this is an organisation which has been set up by a group of people who have some kind of connection with the law, some of them are lawyers, and which is dedicated to pursuing lawfare, that is, the use of the law in warfare, and to sabotage Palestine solidarity work. It's thought that it was set up at the behest of, and after the involvement in a conference organised by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in occupied Palestine, of course. And we've seen reference to it in a number of different shows that we've done over the past few weeks. It's been involved on campus, it's been involved in a number of different legal cases, and here it's been involved with B'nai B'rith, and indeed at the International Criminal Court, producing documents scandalously talking about the pretend Palestinian state. So this is an organisation which is really very, very extreme, and which is involved with this B'nai B'rith organisation, apparently involved in friendly cultural activities where people are getting to know each other and be friendly with each other. But at the same time, they're involved with this other organisation, which is at the far extremes of the Zionist movement. Indeed, even perhaps beyond the extremes of Likudist politics and towards Kahanist politics. So there's something really very worrying about this whole nexus. On the one hand, in the Zionist movement, there are mainstream Zionist organisations which are pretend that they don't really like the settlements, but which nevertheless defend the state of Israel, right or wrong. And then there are a whole range of other very right-wing pro-settler organisations, Kahanist organisations, who believe in genocide, straightforwardly. And then you've got the left, the so-called socialist Zionists or liberal Zionists, and they all believe, in the end, in defending the state of Israel in what they call a big tent for Israel. And so although there is differentiation within the Zionist movement, they all are united in defence of the Israeli state's activities, which of course are themselves war crimes.
I mean, this UK Lawyers for Israel, I mean, where does their resources come from? Are they doing the work sort of pro bono, or are they being funded?
Well, this is what we don't know. We do know some of the money comes from Zionist philanthropists, for example. Gerald Ronson of the Community Security Trust, which we've had cause to mention in this programme before, has funded UK Lawyers for Israel. But presumably, much of the money comes from directly from the State of Israel, perhaps through conduits. We don't know. What we do know is that it has worked with an organisation called Shurat Hadin, which is a law firm in occupied Palestine, which has offices in different parts of the world, and which WikiLeaks documents showed in its early years took direction from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and indeed from the Mossad on which cases to take. And those cases involved things like legal cases against the Gaza flotilla to try and threaten insurance cases or to threaten ports with allowing the ships to depart, etc. So they've been using law as a means to subvert genuine civil society action in support of Palestinian rights.
And perhaps finally, Kit, do you think this controversy over the Bradford Literature Festival is likely to have an impact on any future festivals?
Well, I mean, as I said, they clearly haven't learned lessons from the 2019 fiasco when, they accepted funding without, advertising it particularly clearly from a Home Office counter-extremism initiative, which is engaged in all manner of other astroturf propaganda efforts in other areas of civil society. I mean, I think that maybe the fact that it wasn't that it went ahead and they managed to kind of the controversy blew over somewhat. They thought they'd gotten away with it. So yeah, all the more reason to boycott them this time.
I mean, is your general sense that you know, the Zionist lobby is waning in its influence or increasing in its influence? I mean, what's your thoughts?
I mean, I think, you know, it's somewhat a mixed picture. So, I mean, the rather embarrassingly for the lobby, you know, not long ago, they attempted to deplatform Loki from Spotify on, you know, completely farcical, you know, fraudulent grounds as ever. And, you know, lots of charges and false charges and, you know, slanderous accusations of him being an anti-Semite. And it didn't work out. But, you know, I mean, in other areas, they seem to be making headway. So, yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, and as the recent controversy involving Goldsmith's student union demonstrates, you need to stand up to these people and you need to respond very, very robustly, because, you know, if you give them an inch, they will take a mile and then some, and they will not stop. So, you know, this stuff needs to be opposed very, very aggressively and robustly.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much indeed, Kit, for your input today. And thank you, David. We're going to have to leave it there now, because unfortunately we are out of time. We'll be back next week with more news and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Researchers are learning more about how the SARS-CoV-2 coronavirus stifles smell and how they might revive it. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Michael Marshall Ryder. This article is published under the heading COVID and Smell Loss. Answers begin to emerge. Here's more. Researchers are finally making headway in understanding how the SARS-CoV-2 coronavirus causes loss of smell, and a multitude of potential treatments to tackle the condition are undergoing clinical trials, including esteroids and blood plasma. Once a telltale sign of COVID-19, smell disruption is becoming less common as the virus evolves. Our inboxes are not as flooded as they used to be, says Valentina Parma, a psychologist at the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, who helped field desperate inquiries from patients throughout the first 2 years of the pandemic. A study published last month surveyed 616,318 people in the U.S. who had COVID-19. It found that compared with those who had been infected with the original virus, people who had contracted the Alpha variant, the first variant of concern to arise, were 50% as likely to have chemosensory disruption. This probability fell to 44% for the later Delta variant and to 17% for the latest variant, Omicron. But the news is not all good. A significant portion of people infected early in the pandemic still experience chemosensory effects. A 2021 study followed 100 people who had had mild cases of COVID-19 and 100 people who repeatedly tested negative. More than a year after their infections, 46% of those who had had COVID-19 still had smell problems. By contrast, just 10% of the control group had developed some smell loss, but for other reasons. Furthermore, 7% of those who had been infected still had total smell loss or anosmia at the end of the year. Given that more than 500 million cases of COVID-19 had been confirmed worldwide, tens of millions of people probably have lingering smell problems. For these people, help can't come soon enough. Simple activities such as tasting food or smelling flowers are now really emotionally distressing, Parma says. A clearer picture of how SARS-CoV-2 causes this disruption should help to create better therapies for the condition. Early in the pandemic, a study showed that the virus attacks cells in the nose called sustenonuclear cells that provide nutrients and support to other sensing neurons. Since then, clues have emerged about what happens to the olfactory neurons after infection. Researchers, including biochemist Stavros Lomrados at Columbia University, New York, examined people who had died from COVID-19 and found that although their neurons were intact, they had fewer membrane-embedded receptors for detecting odor molecules than usual. This was because the neurons' nuclei had been scrambled. Normally, the chromosomes in these nuclei are organized into two compartments, a structure that enables the neurons to express specific odor receptors at high levels. But when the team looked at the autopsied neurons, the nuclear architecture was unrecognizable, Lombard says. Other studies suggest why only some people experience long-term smell loss. In January, a research team reported finding a genetic mutation in people that was associated with a greater propensity for smell or taste loss. The mutation, a change to a single letter or base of DNA, was found in two overlapping genes called UGT2A1 and UGT2A2. Both encode proteins that remove odor molecules from the nostrils after they have been detected. But it's not yet clear how SARS-CoV-2 interacts with these genes. There is also evidence of lasting changes to the brain for people with smell loss. In a study published in March 6, 6,785 people in the U.S. had their brains scanned twice. About 400 people became infected with COVID-19 between scans, so the scientists were able to observe structural changes. The COVID-19 survivors showed multiple changes, including markers of tissue damage in areas likened to the brain's olfactory center. It's not clear why this was the case, but one possibility is lack of input. In the meantime, many treatments are being explored, often in small clinical trials. but it's still early days. So the only thing that most researchers recommend for now is smell training. Patients are given samples of strong-smelling substances to sniff and try to identify, with the aim of driving the restoration of olfactory signaling. However, the method seems to work only with people who have partial smell loss, Reed says. That means it helps about one-third of people who experienced a chemosensory disruption after COVID-19, adds Parma. To find treatments for everyone else, many researchers are exploring esteroids, which reduce inflammation. COVID-19 is known to trigger extensive inflammation, which might play a part in a smell disruption. So, in theory, esteroids could help, but in practice, the results have been disappointing. For instance, a 2021 study gave a smell training to 100 people with post-COVID anosmia. 50 of them also received a nasal spray with esteroid memostone furoate, while the other 50 did not. There was no significant difference in outcome between the two groups. And another therapeutic possibility is platelet-rich plasma. This is made from patients' own blood and is rich in biochemicals that might induce healing. A pilot study published in 2020 followed 7 patients who had platelet-rich plasma injected into their noses. 5 showed improvement after 3 months. Similarly, a preprint published in February this year followed 56 people and found that platelet-rich plasma made them more sensitive to smells. But these are really small numbers, says Carl Pilot, a nose and sinus specialist at the University of East Anglia, Norwich, UK. A US-based team is now launching a larger study. Pilot is in early stages of a small study of vitamin A, which previous experiments have suggested could help with other forms of smell loss. Pilot says, "The reality is that the study will take the rest of this year to run, and it will take us probably to the middle of next year before we analyze the data and report it. If we find a positive benefit, our next job will be to apply for more funding to do a full stage trial."
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly, I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly, she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini l-Islami dini wal-Azam ghayru dini Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about the rules, Islamic jurisprudential laws about the media, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. And as always, our guest speaker, Sheikh Javid. Let's talk about some of the questions and concepts about media, jurisprudentially speaking, of course, according to the rulings of Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, what is Ayatollah Khamenei's view, let's say, on watching satellite programs? Is it permissible for, people living in some neighboring provinces or border towns, for example?
Sure.
All right, to the other countries, let's say, to see and watch their television stations or programs?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Programs broadcast via Western satellite television stations and those of most of the neighboring countries teach, you know, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, teach misleading thoughts and they tend to misrepresent things. So misrepresentation is a common thing. They try to portray things which are not true as true and which are true as false. So that's part of the Western media or satellite television stations. They also contain, licentious, frivolous, a kind of forbidden, obscene music, vulgar music, which is also forbidden according to Islam, and watching them, watching such movies which contain music, haram music, and vulgar music songs, of course, leads to kind of mafsada or corruption or mischief or evil, whatever you term it. So it also, kind of misleading. They people end up going astray watching such things and, mm-hmm. you know, committing haram acts. Right. You know. So it's not permissible to access these channels to watch the programs they broadcast according to Ayatollah Khamenei. You know, as I also mentioned, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, if you're watching, of course, let's say documentary, NA documentaries,
yes.
or things which are absolutely halal, essentially halal, like let's say watching Quranic competition broadcast by a neighboring country, let's say. So, and if you're confident that you will watch only halal things and
right.
there's no objection to you,
mm-hmm.
it is permissible, even though it's broadcast on a satellite channel.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Sheikh Javid, is there any jurisprudential problem in watching or listening to, you know, funny programs, comical, you know, programs and episodes broadcast from either the radio or television?
Well, there is no problem in listening to such programs and, let's say, humorous shows mm-hmm. or watching them, provided that they do not involve insult to a believer or they do not involve backbiting or they do not involve some kind of degradation of someone. Because, you know, just as we sometimes see, it's very much very common that some, let's say, stand-up comedies are...
pretty common.
Yeah, it's very common that some people are spoken mm-hmm. ill of. And some people, other people are degraded and, you know, some insult is thrown at some other people. Mm-hmm. So if such programs include insult to some mm-hmm. people, it's
yes.
not permissible to be a part of it, to watch it. Otherwise, it is permissible.
Mm. You talked about insult as a kind of, let's say, you know, a standard or cornerstone to, you know, make it somehow like objectionable, all right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But the thing is, what about the jokes, for example, in a stand-up comedy that they tell, especially yes. these comedians tell, or in such satirical programs,
right.
or comical programs, and especially about the private parts or the sex. And that comes up a lot in these jokes.
Mm-hmm.
If some of these jokes are involved, then does it make it haram or objectionable?
Well, jokes are not forbidden per se. You know, you can crack jokes, you know. But, you know, depending on the impact and consequences, if those jokes are, let's say, sexual and, you know, and they kind of lead you
yes.
to something haram, or maybe you might end up doing something haram because that's the consequence mm-hmm. of cracking mm-hmm. jokes mm-hmm. with someone, and jokes about sexuality or, you know, about private parts. Of course, it is it's not permissible. Mm-hmm.
I see. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about the rules of media according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, is there any problem for women, for example, like kissing the photos of the late Imam Khomeini, or the martyrs, for example, in those Muslim countries where there has been a war, for example, because they're basically the non-mahrams and they're still kissing, for example, a non-mahram's picture. Is it permissible for them to do so?
Well, generally speaking, the pictures of people do not have the same ruling of the people themselves. In other words, the rules which apply to the people themselves do not apply to the mm-hmm. pictures.
Yes.
Of course, the pictures are printed on paper, and of course, there's no problem, and there's no objection to someone, to a woman, let's say, kissing the pictures of the martyrs as a mark or as a sign of respect or sign of love, and, you know, showing, let's say, dignity and respect for those noble people, for those martyrs, provided that, you know, no evil intention is harbored, for example. And then it's if a person is confident that he will not fall into a sinful act as a result of, let's say, kissing the picture of a martyr, let's say, there's no problem.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said, you know, there we must differentiate between a picture and an individual himself.
I see. What about the pictures of semi-naked or naked women unknown to us? Like, as you can see, these movies or films, you know, these women appearing in different places here and there in some of the television series or programs and movies. If they are unknown to us, does it make it permissible to watch?
Well, generally speaking, like I said, watching movie, watching pictures and photographs, even if those pictures or photographs are moving pictures, does not have the same ruling as looking in reality at people who are non-mahram to you. They are totally different things, you know. So there is no objection to watching them, to seeing them, according to Islamic law and according to Islamic Sharia. And if, of course, it's very much necessary that watching them or seeing them is not done with lust or with evil intention, and it does not lead to a bad result or a bad consequence or to any mischief, fitna, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So since watching obscene pictures is inherently intertwined with looking with some kind of sexual urge, mm-hmm. urge with sexual, you know, excitation,
mm-hmm.
and it is a kind of precursor to committing haram acts, it is therefore haram, you know,
mm-hmm.
watching such movies, such pictures which are pictures of women who are partially naked,
mm-hmm.
is kind of, as I said, it's a kind of precursor to committing haram things.
I see.
Granite
so
Al-Khamenei
it's much better to avoid
it is,
watching them, right?
Ayatollah Khamenei says it's therefore, it's based on this presumption, it is haram to watch such pictures.
See. Thank you very much. Esther.
In the event that you are confident that you will not fall and there is no such lustful intention, mm-hmm. there is no objection to you seeing them and watching them.
I appreciate it.
Thank you
very much for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. shortwave, 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.